You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. We got a potluck for you today. This is where you send in the questions. We will answer them. It's a great episode full of all kinds of really good questions. We're going to get right into it. We're sponsored by three awesome companies today. Prismic. They are the hosted headless CMS, Sentry, error exception performance tracking, and FreshBooks Online accounting bookkeeping software. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I'm doing good, man. I'm just tweaking my shell here a bit. Not my turtle shell, my prompt. I guess it's my prompt, my prompt. Yeah. Prompt. Yeah, I'm trying to my posh. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's pretty neat.
Is that a ZSH prompt? Yeah. Or
it's a ZSH prompt and a lot of really nice config options, a lot of really nice default themes, and a ton of really interesting features. So I don't know, give them a check.
That's cool. I recently switched over to Warp, and because they finally let you use your existing prompt on it. And I was very happy. Although, like, one of the features of Warp is the ability to keep all of your prompt and everything when you're SSHing into another box, which is great. Because, like, have you ever, like, you log into a server or even you log into your Synology and, like, you've lost all your...
Yeah, I hate
everything
that
makes you comfortable in the shell. So one of the features of Warp is supposed to be that you keep all of that and all of your shortcuts and everything. I couldn't get it to work. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but I really want that.
I know I think about installing ZSH on like everything, like whether it's my Raspberry Pi or any of that stuff. I'm like, well, maybe I'll take some time to install some ZSH on here. And then I'm thinking about it. I'm like, I think I can get by. I think
I'll be fine. I had it on all of my servers. And it was great. I just set up the like prompt to be random. I guess I didn't need a whole lot of stuff in there, but it was nice to just have it better than like the brutal terminal that comes by default, you know, or the prompt,
brutal prompt. Yeah.
You always have to type PWD to find out where you are and what an awful like initial experience, you know?
Yeah, I hear you.
All right, let's get into the first question here from Nick Hebert. How do you generally resolve errors when starting up a project with NPM that you haven't touched in a while? Is perhaps the version of Node for the project isn't installed in your machine? I generally find this happens. My solution is recreating the project every single time, which isn't sustainable, and the projects will never continue. I can't seem to find the Node version for the projects. Gatsby.js, in this instance, big fan of the show. All right, yeah, that can be a bit of an issue because, like, I've said this many times, is web development projects rot over time, meaning that you unfortunately can't just leave them, especially if you're just using Node, like most of us, you're just using Node in your command line and you're updating versions of Node, and the older version of your project was installed with a different version. So generally the way that I'll approach one of these things is first you can throw the entire thing into, if this is really a big issue for you or this is mission critical, you can throw this entire thing into a Docker image. And what that will allow you to do is to isolate literally everything about the project into its own image so that other things on your computer are not running, like giving you grief about that type of thing. Second, generally when you switch Node versions, you're going to want to do an NPM install again on your project. So just nuke the Node modules folder. Sometimes delete the package lock file, but the benefit of the package lock file is that it spells out exactly what version of every package was used to install were running. So if you delete the package lock, then you are going to get the latest, let's say it was working on 4.2.1 and now 4.2.6 is out. If you nuke your package lock, you're going to get the latest 4.2.6. Like not the latest, like if a 4.6 comes out or a 5 comes out, you're not going to get that, but you'll get the minor version release. And most cases is not a big deal, but it could be. So nuke the Node modules folder and run npm install again. And that usually gets you there. very rarely do projects drop like full node versions, especially like unless you're coming like 3 years later, you're not really gonna have it. Have you run into that where like, oh, like it was made on node 15? Like some of my stuff runs 10 versions node old and it still works great.
I actually do run into that at various points where just something won't work. Even I think there was like a SvelteKit update I did recently where they bumped up the node version and I had to update. But I actually found it quite a bit with, I think there was like Gatsby projects in the past had like changed to node version. But I like to keep on top of that anyways, just to have a newer version of node. You know, you got to have those latest goodies and all that stuff. So, you know what I found interesting, Wes, is that, you know, you've been using PNPM, right?
Yeah.
PNPM has a thing in their package.json that allows you to specify the node version. And this might be things in outside of PNPM as well. But in PNPM, you can have an engines property and you can specify a greater than 17.0, whatever, for node version, but also for PNPM version. We recently updated our PNPM to version 7, specifically 7.5 something, because we wanted to take advantage of the new patch package stuff that's built in. And so I added these engine support. And sure enough, when I went to deploy my site, it yelled at me saying my node version wasn't high enough. So I had to tweak my node version. So yeah, I use that engines to make sure that whoever is running it isn't running on an older version. But I don't get too much into the Docker stuff myself.
No, me neither. Like I've never been like a fan. I understand the benefit and I use Docker for everything on my Synology, but I've never been one to like, oh, let's make a Docker image of this. And I know there's people that are bonkers over doing everything Docker, but
yeah,
it's not for me. But that engines property is a standard field in your package.json and it will warn. So you can set your engines for NPM and for node, and you can set like greater than or equal to and less than or equal to, or you can set the exact version that you need. And if you do not have that version, it will throw a warning. You can also, in your NPM RC file, you can put an engine strict equals true flag and it will literally not let you start it. That's kind of a pain because NPM itself doesn't have a way to switch what version of node you're on. And then you're going down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out that out. So it's a bit easier with PNPM because PNPM will literally allow you to switch your node versions. So that's pretty sweet.
Cool. Next question here is from Mike. I was never interested in social media, but I've heard a few times how important networking is. I've been trying to be more involved in various communities, but I feel out of place. I mention people and hashtags in my tweets, posts, etc., but I feel like I'm being a nuisance. How often do you directly mention other individuals? Do you worry about it coming off as annoying? Do you just tweet your thoughts and let others find it organically? Thanks for answering and a great podcast. So Mike, you know what? I think the big thing you got to realize about some of this stuff is there's a couple of facets to here. Sometimes I am just tweeting my random thoughts. Like the other day I tweeted that I do like a 360 spin on my treadmill desk all the time, which is actually, it's very scary when I do it. I like pretend like I'm in like the football combine or something. I do like, oh, and I do like a 360 on my walking treadmill at my desk. And so those kind of things, I'm not expecting anybody to like that. And, you know, the only reason I even tweet that is maybe somebody would find that funny and they'd giggle at it or something. But like for the most part, I'm not pinging people unless I'm saying something wonderful or nice about them. Like pinging Wes Boss, man, I came across your blog post today and it was super helpful. You're the best. Like that's when I'm going to ping somebody. When I get annoyed is when people ping either Wes and I and it's like, I have a object is not defined bug. Wes and Scott, what do you think? Like, man, I don't know. I don't got time to fix that yourself for you. Fix it for yourself.
I get that a lot too. It's really annoying when I don't mind when people say like, hey, have you ever had this issue? I don't mind. I either ignore it or I say, I don't have time for it. Or I say, I have had that issue. Here's how we can get into it. What I find really annoying is that people they'll post like an infographic or they'll just like post like a thought or a link to their blog post. And then they'll tag like me, Scott, Chris Coyer,
Dan Abramov. Yeah.
Yeah. Like tag everybody in that. It's just like, no, we're not going to retweet it. And then you get all these people reply chaining to every single person on it. And that's super, super annoying. It seems like those people don't understand the like
etiquette.
Yeah. Etiquette to like, it's pretty simple. Like just don't, if we're literally not involved in your thing and you're just trying to tag onto our accounts to get eyeballs on it. It's the same thing with, if someone posts an image, they'll tag me in the image, even mm-hmm. though it has nothing to do with me, because they're hoping the Twitter algorithm of people that follow me start to show up. That tends to happen. I can generally feel when somebody is being disingenuous, and I from your question, I don't feel like you're actually doing that. I think people who do that are just trying to game the algorithm and sort of like piggyback on some of the followings that we've built.
Yeah, it feels like you're just using us for our clout.
Yeah. So what do you do? You literally just, I think you share what you're doing. You share questions that you might have out there. You look for other people that are asking for questions and feedback. I'll often post just open-ended questions, either because I'm looking for help on something and I have an incredible resource of people that are much smarter than me who will help me out. Or like I'm literally just like looking for like trying to gauge the temperature of like where people at. Like, hey, like, what do you think about, there's two ways to do an if statement here. What's your approach? And I love questions like that because you often get insights into things that I would never have even thought about. So definitely recommend social media. And I know a lot of people think it's kind of a waste of time, and some days I wish I didn't have to do it, but at the end of the day, I kind of owe a lot of my career to it. And I think it's kind of panned out for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of the things you want to do is if you want to be growing more people who are following you on social media in that type of way, sharing anything of value is always going to be positive. Just be aware that like, it's not going to necessarily get picked up automatically and people won't share it automatically. And you're not just overnight going to get a ton of followers or a ton of people finding your stuff from sharing value one time. It's going to take like a commitment and some like effort, some long-term working there, and just, you know, do a little bit every day here and there, and you'll get there.
Yeah. I often wonder that, like, do you think there's people can still gain a large following genuinely on Twitter? Or yeah, I think so too. Like, you see a lot of people doing the like threads, here's 10 thing. And it's like very like, I don't mind the threads, but like there's people that have figured out the algorithm and they've figured out the patterns that work well. And they, for some reason, those just rub me the wrong way because it's, I don't know, like it doesn't seem as genuine as just like, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here, but they just rub me the wrong way.
I think the disingenuous anything kind of comes across. And if you're doing something just with specifically of the goal of gaming the system or whatever, and your goal isn't to share value or it isn't to, you know, be friends with people or whatever, people can see through that in an instant. And I personally like, will totally get turned off of any of that type of content if I can smell the, I don't know, ingenuineness of it all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which is weird because like TikTok is very much a little bit of both. There's lots of people on TikTok who have absolutely figured out the recipe for doing it, and they just do it over and over and over and over and over. And if you look back at their videos, it's just them doing the same thing slightly different. Like I got an ad on YouTube the other day, and there was a guy walking through the airport filming himself and says, do you know the fastest way to use effect in React is to blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what is going on here? This guy's like clearly just walking through the airport to give it some sort of like atmosphere. Right. And I kept getting the ad over and over, and he just kind of did the same thing over again. And he was on the beach at one point. And then like the stuff he was saying was not true. Like he's like, use effect is the most powerful dynamic tool of possible in making React applications. And I was like, like, no, like, oh, it's just like one thing that we use. And, but then like he's pushing some product or whatever. And like, I should talk, I sell products as well, but it just, again, It didn't feel good, but it had incredible uptake as well.
There's something very weird about that. You know what? If we're gonna say like stuff that we don't like, I really don't like when it's like here are the top 10 places, or here's the top 10 things to learn in React. It is just some guy being like point.
Yeah. Point. Oh yeah.
Like here are the things here are the places to go to learn React. Here's the techniques that you should. I saw one. It was like, here's the best place to go to learn React in 2022. And it was like the React docs. The React docs are out of date. They're like, they don't even show hooks as like the way of doing things. Like, would I go to the React docs first and foremost? No, probably not.
Yeah. It's just someone just Googled and then gave you the top 10. Oh, it's like, I can React do docs. That myself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Anyways, I like sometimes I complain about this stuff and I'm like, am I just getting old or like, or am I being like, am I gatekeeping here? Cause like I have a large following and I built that genuinely. And now these kids are cracking the code and running it up. And so sometimes I wonder if I'm just being grumpy or not, but that's good to hear.
I would have had the same opinion before. Cause I've always been, you know, my YouTube channel and everything was always about like providing value first and foremost, but like, I don't see a ton of value in just Googling, you know, React. I mean, all right, react.com. That's the place to learn React. You know, I don't see any value there. So I don't know. I feel like I probably would have had the same feeling before, but who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. I think long-term the being genuine will always pan out. You certainly can trick it here and there, but I think that stuff will fade.
To you.
All right, next question from Joe. What bundler are you reaching for when building a React component library? I don't have a React component library, so I'll refer to you on this one, Scott.
I don't have a React component library either, but if I'm reaching for anything in this regard, we did at one point, and you know what? I've always liked TSDX. Shout out to Jared Palmer who made this thing. Initially, TSDX is basically a starter for this exact type of thing, and it has all of the things you'd want. You know, the ability to bundle and prepare your library, and it has all the tools that you'd want for writing a library in TypeScript with, which honestly, if you're shipping a library at this point, you'd probably want to be shipping a TypeScript library just because, you know, people these days kind of expect that everything has types. So if I'm doing it React based, I'm going to pick up TSDX. We'll have the link to that in the show notes, tsdx.io. But I've been doing this a lot with Svelte, and Svelte has it baked in. SvelteKit has a package command baked in. So I just make a SvelteKit app and I run SvelteKit package. So shout out to me and SvelteKit.
I was just gonna say like Vite is probably a good option now as well. Mm-hmm. Because you can have multiple inputs and multiple outputs with Vite very easily. So I would probably just reach for Vite. I don't think TSDX is being worked on still, is it? I feel like I heard that at some point.
You mean you think it's like deprecated?
Yeah, not deprecated, but like just not being updated. Last commit was February 28th. That was to master, though. Let's see.
Yeah, but it's pretty. I don't know. It's pretty.
Or maybe it's just done. Yeah. You know, it's just got what you need. Yeah. Cool. All right. Next question we have here from Thomas Rosalski. That's like Talinsky. That's maybe your cousin. Hi, folks. Do you have experience optimizing third-party scripts like Google Analytics? It seems like we have quite a few fresh ways using web workers. Through a tool like PartyTown. What are your thoughts? Thanks. Love everything from the community. I don't have any experience doing this type of thing because Google Analytics now gives you ways to do it asynchronously, and they give you a way to defer the loading of the script. And I don't see any additional benefit of doing it in a web worker. Do you?
I don't know personally, but I have been seeing a lot about PartyTown specifically. In fact, someone from PartyTown even reached out to us about coming out of the show. It's an interesting thing. They say, here we go, let's do use cases for code that doesn't need to be in the critical rendering path. Yeah.
PartyTown is a lazy loaded library to help relocate resource intensive scripts to a web worker and off the main thread. The goal is to help speed up sites by dedicating a main thread to your code and offloading third-party scripts to a web worker.
So that seems to be the benefit, is that you're dealing with threads here where, you know, if you have your website, it's not like you get any control over that. So by moving it over to a worker, you're now like being able to move intensive processes to another thread, which is so funny because as web developers, if we were to talk about like threading along, you know, a couple years ago, you'd just be like, what? Why? You know, why? But now it seems to make more sense now that we're doing more and more stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Some of these websites have 7-8 different tracking pixels and analytics and click codes. And I could see that, like, mm-hmm. all of that stuff really will bog down your application. I've never been one for heavy. I'll throw Google Analytics on some websites. I noticed the other day, we don't even have Google Analytics or any analytics on the Syntax website. I don't necessarily know if we need it or not, but
YOLO. Yeah, I don't necessarily like who'd be looking at that. Are you going to be analyzing that? I don't know if I will.
So I guess so, but I would probably say, like, is Google Analytics really slowing you down? Do you have data on that type of thing, or is that just something you know that is kind of slowing you down? The Google Analytics people, I know people like to complain about it, but I generally know that they do care about performance as well.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't think Google Analytics is going to be the thing, like you've said, that's slowing you down. I don't think that's going to be it, as much as, you know, it is probably not helping things. That's probably not going to be the thing that sinks you in any meaningful kind of way. All right. Next question is from Thomas. Thomas says, what's your opinion on an offline first mentality? I started using PouchDB recently. It's a database on the front end that automatically replicates itself with a CouchDB instance on the server. You don't have to worry about server-side communication, and changes are reflected instantly in the UI. I really like this approach because the user may use the app without even registering an account. Only when they need data synchronization across multiple devices do they need to log in. RxDB is a new implementation of this idea. I'd love to hear your opinion on this. I've never heard of this, but I love the idea of PouchDB here because, you know, that is kind of been the problem for me with any sort of offline first data stuff. You have to think about those aspects, the data synchronization, right? If you're saving everything in a local database or locally storing that database for offline use, how do you deal with those synchronizations? And the fact that this just does it without you having to think about it seems like a pretty big win to me. So, I don't know. You know, I'm going to maybe give PouchDB a try here because this is something that I would love to get more into for an app that I'm building right now. In fact, I was just, I've been working on my B-Boy Tools app, which is a dance app. I've been going to dance practice again every week. And I decided to spin up a B-Boy Tools site, and I was using Supabase for it, and it's great. But I did notice that I'm in the dance studio, and the dance studio has terrible Wi-Fi, and I don't get good cell signal there. So here I'm trying to use my app. It's got swipe gestures, and the swipe gesture completes, but then the database hasn't updated, or it's taking for a long time. And I was just thinking, like, this would be really great if I had some sort of local solution for this and then syncing the data. So maybe a solution like PouchDB or something like that is the answer. But thanks for putting this on my radar. I know I haven't done any work with CouchDB myself, but CouchDB is one of those ones that you see all around. There's like so many of these like minor little databases. I don't know if you've seen like MariaDB and CouchDB and CockroachDB and all these things that they just... You can't spend all that time working on databases unless that's your thing. So I don't know. I'll take a look at this. It looks interesting.
Yeah, I think if you need to build an app that works on spotty internet, like a big one is if you live in a city that has a subway and you are using the app, you duck into the subway, you duck out, or you're on and off. Absolutely. You need to think about this stuff very, very early. Otherwise you're going to have to build your own solution that sort of syncs data when you're offline. So I know MongoDB has one called Realm. I've not used that myself. I think Firebase does something similar as well. Essentially, just like you just keep using the app and then you can show that there are unsynced changes at some point. You can run into issues like what happens if somebody else's, like a Notion, for example, you use Notion offline. And then somebody else deletes the document where you're typing when you're offline, you come back on, then you have merge conflicts, right? Mm-hmm. This certainly could be issues there, but yeah, it's pretty cool. I think that is a great thing to think about very early on in your application because it can be made very, very easy. You know what else is easy, Scott?
Oh, is it working with data with Prismic?
Yes, Prismic is a headless CMS where you can build websites with it. So what Prismic is you sign up for Prismic, you create all of your content types that you wish to have. You can relate them. You can have different fields for each of your content types. And you can start building reusable sections of your website that are called slices. And this is a pretty cool way to build your website because if you mirror your data creation over, I want a little bit of this data and a little bit of this data, a little bit of this data, you click them all together. Those are all different slices that are made into an entire pizza pie or an entire website. And then you, the web developer, can take that via either the REST API or the GraphQL API, and you can loop over those slices and render out the associated components. So if you've got a person component, you can render out each person. If you've got a show component, you can render out a show for that. And I personally used it on one of my wife's websites a couple months ago, and it worked really well because I didn't want her to tell me every single time she wanted to change the website, but I did know like these are the pieces of data she will have, and then she can pick which data goes on which page, and the thing will just automatically update for it. So it's a headless CMS, but it's also kind of a website builder, which is pretty neat. So check it out, prismic.io/syntax. And they've got a whole bunch of starters there. Thank you, Prismic, for sponsoring. All right, next question we got here from Ryan. How do you make web components with Svelte? Do either of you know? I've heard on multiple podcasts at this point that Svelte is good at making web components, but I've had trouble finding good resources on how to do this. So we had the creator of Svelte on the other day, and actually, probably by the time this airs, we haven't had him on, but he said web components are good, but not as good as Svelte components. So have you done this before, Scott?
I haven't. And I, you know what, mostly just because I haven't had the need to. I don't necessarily understand why you would need to. Maybe you're working on a library that is meant to be consumed outside of Svelte and you want to write it in Svelte. But then again, there's an official template that shows you how to use this. The long story short here is that in the Svelte compiler, which compiles your Svelte file to JavaScript, there is an option. And that option is just simply custom element, where you can set that custom element to be true. And then you will have to, there's some like weird interop stuff with like, if you're building a Svelte site, and it's like normal components talking to normal components, you're not consuming this thing outside of Svelte in any sort of way, there's no reason to do this. But if you want to write something that's a library that's going to be consumed outside of it, then you would just compile it essentially to custom elements. Because what you get into is you end up getting into like a weird situation where if you're wanting to use a web component in Svelte that's compiled in Svelte like this, you have to, the syntax becomes weird and you use a Svelte options tag and then tag is equal to whatever the tag name is. There's really not a whole ton of point into doing this unless it said you're building something to ship outside of. But what you're looking for, the reason, you know, you might not be seeing this is if you want a good, you know, documentation on how to do this thing, you want to be looking at the Svelte compiler option of custom element. And that is what gives you the ability to output your components as Svelte. There, in fact, you know what? I'll link to a blog post here called Build Custom Elements Build Custom Web Components with Svelte, and it's from LogRocket, one of our sponsors. Yeah, so LogRocket will get some nice clicks off of that one, but it shows you exactly what to do, and it also gets into the pros and cons of this all. But again, like I said, if you're just right working on a Svelte site, not a lot of upside to this one.
Yeah, that would be cool, though, if like you don't like the authoring experience of web components.
Yes.
But you could write them in Svelte and then export them, because like now, once we had the interview, I finally understand the whole like compiling down to JavaScript instead of shipping the library. So I think that would be pretty cool.
For those of you who are wondering what Wes is talking about, we have Rich on the show. We've recorded the episode, but you will not be hearing it for a couple of weeks here. So I know we've referenced that a couple of times. Rich Harris has been on Syntax, and that will be dropping very
soon. So good. It was awesome. Such a good episode. I'm really excited to get that one out.
It's so good, and you guys can't hear it. So we're just going to keep talking about how good it is until it's released. All right, next question is from Joe. Hi, guys. Thanks for all the great content. When talking about responsive web design, do people generally mean using Flexbox or Grid, or is it a broader term encompassing media queries? Now, the responsive web design term was coined by Ethan Marcotte, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm trying to pull up his book. His book of the same name on a responsive list apart web of Book Apart Report.
Okay, and 11 years ago that book was pushed out.
Yeah, and you want to talk about a book that completely changed the web design world. My team got this book, and we really, really dove into this thing. And I remember the very first website my boss built with a responsive web design was a cafe's website, a local cafe. And I remember him showing me on his mobile phone how nice the menu looked. Like the menu where you order things. It's like, oh, if you go to this website on a phone, it automatically shows the menu, and the menu is formatted in a single column for the phone. And I was just thinking, like, this is incredible. Like, this is so cool. Because responsive web design at the end of the day was at that time when responsive web design came out, you had a lot of sites that were shipping a mobile specific version of the site that was its own code base. And that was its own separate project to adjust to the needs of mobile web design. They were using jQuery UI or jQuery mobile, whatever that was, or they were using these things to try to make it look like a native app. But many people were redirecting on mobile devices to m. whatever the URL is and having a separate mobile experience. And responsive web design basically said, listen, we can have the same experience. We can have the same code base using media queries, using percentage-based values, using those types of things rather than hard-coding pixels here or there or whatever. And you can use those techniques to have a site that at the different breakpoints can adjust its layout and can share the exact same content in a way that feels good on all devices without having two separate projects. And once that book came out, man, what was it? What was the old version of that called where you had a mobile site? It was called
like an m. site.
Yeah, whatever. That technique was dead in the water right when responsive web design came out. So when people are talking about what is responsive web design, it's mostly about being able to ship one code base using CSS and having that layout adjust. Now, there's a whole nother point of that where they call it mobile first, where you design your site so that the CSS without breakpoints is mobile friendly, and then the breakpoints just add in the desktop layouts. Or you could do it the opposite of that, or you could do some sort of willy-nilly hybrid of the two. Either way, it is through the usage of things like media queries, but also percentage-based events. And sure, Flexbox and Grid, these things have some amazing tools that have really helped out with that. Now we have even more things like that, like Clamp. And furthermore, we're going to be getting Element queries, which is going to just completely dominate that landscape in a way that I don't think many people truly understand the ways that Element queries will take over completely. So responsive web design, it's your site responds to the viewport it's in.
Yeah. I remember, this is me being old man internet again, I think it was 2011. I was talking with at jQuery TO, I think Matt Marquis, and I think Ethan was there. So they're working on the Boston Globe website, which was like the first like major website to roll out responsive design. And I remember it was just unreal of that you could just have one website for all this. And that was like, 12 years ago. And now there's one news website in Canada that still doesn't even, not even have like a m. They still have an m. site, but it's 320 pixels wide. And literally, if you like go on any device, it's 320 pixels wide.
Oh my
God.
Yeah. Awful. So, yeah, responsive dying sure has come a long way. And, that it's funny with all these things, Grid and Flexbox, we use less and less media queries, certainly still use lots of media queries, but, responsive design encompasses just the idea that your website will look good and work at any size screen.
Yeah. And thank goodness. Cause man, that previous iteration before responsive web design was a big pain in the butt.
Yeah.
I'm going to start saying bun for every time I say butt. I mean, it's a big pain in the bun. Speaking about pain in the buns is if you have bugs in your website, that can be really big bummer. I don't know. I was trying to work that in somehow. Could be a big bummer here. Sorry. We just recorded an episode on bun and I'm pretty into it. So Sentry at sentry.io is the perfect place to see all of your errors and exceptions happening. In fact, like I said, I use this thing all the time. In fact, I'm on here just about every day. I'm checking the performance of my site. I'm checking its error status. I'm seeing if there's any major bugs across the UI or the API or any of my services that result in users having a bad time on my site. In fact, it looks like I have one error that's hitting some people here. Not allowed by the user agent of this platform. Oof. Maybe I should figure out why it's not allowed and what's going on here. Let's do with my player. Could be something that's not getting resolved correctly. So something I want to check out. This is a new bug for me. So what I can do is I can go ahead and I can say, ooh, you know what? I want to turn this into a GitHub issue and I want to assign it to me directly from Sentry. And then that way, when I fix the problem, I can make sure that I keep track of everything where this is. And then I can say, oh, I fixed this problem. I can hit the check mark to say that this thing is resolved. And then I can make sure it doesn't come back, because what I have is I have alerts set up for if I have a regression in my code base, it's going to send me an email saying you have a regression. Here's something that you thought you did, but you didn't do it right. So if you want to get all of that and more, head on over to Sentry at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. Thank you so much for Sentry for making our websites feel and work way better.
Next question we have here from Daniel. Hi, guys. I'm a full-time freelance dev, heavily focused on React project. My cousin asked for a simple portfolio website. I want to spend as little time as possible as I'll do it for free. Do you have any tips for staying in React land for just spinning up a fresh site quickly? The best solution I've found so far is Gatsby Starters. Many thanks. Keep up the best pod. Peace. So this is a common thing where you have somebody who wants a website and you want to help them out because you want to throw them a bone and you like them, but you don't want to spend too much time on it. And then you also have to think about like updating this website whenever they want to change something down the road, right? Like, because this is like a puppy that you're buying and you have to support this puppy its entire life, unfortunately. So you need to really think about the tech that is used. And I'm going to say that, first of all, I would probably say try put them on Squarespace, WordPress website, something like that initially, because at some point you're going to get sick of having to update this type of thing. If you really don't want to do it, if you are like, oh yeah, I would love to build a website for them, then yeah, then I would look at, a Gatsby starter would probably be a good idea, because it's like you're halfway there or three quarters of the way there already. I would probably look at trying to integrate it with, I know that we have a sponsor, but maybe even look at integrating it with Prismic, because if you can lay the pages out, not in terms of what they ask for, but in terms of the slices that Prismic uses, then if they want to change something or they want to add something, I'm saying this as somebody who has built a lot of websites for friends and family. They will always ask you to, how do I add a calendar above this thing? How do I change this? How do I put a little banner that says I'm on vacation? And there's lots of those little death by a thousand cuts. And if you can give them a tool where they can update it themselves, both the content as well as ideally the layout, and that's what Prismic will give you both of, I think that would be a good step forward. And you can use that with Gatsby as well. So I would probably say, go get the HTML, the CSS from a Gatsby starter, integrate some sort of light CMS where they can edit the content themselves, and you're up and running.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, I specifically don't do a lot of projects like this. So just because I like I said, I have real puppies and I got kids. I do not need digital puppies. That's for
yeah,
sure.
I always think about that because I have a lot of friends that are electricians and plumbers and masons, and they're the type of friends where you just like ask them for help. When like, oh, hey, I need to put a new circuit in, or, I need to point some brick on my house before we sell it. And like, those are just like a one day favor things. And then it's done forever. But with a website, there's just like an ongoing relationship. Like I pay $15 a year I pay for my buddy's domain name every year, $15. Right. And I host it on my own server. And it's just like, now this is a thing that I have forever. And it's okay because it's my friend and I like him and he helps me out when I need help. But you got to be kind of careful because these things live on forever, whereas other types of help can just be done nice and tidy.
Yeah. I love it. Next question here was from Kyle. Hey, Scott and Wes. Who or what helps you produce and distribute the podcast? What does the team look like? What are your retirement plans? Oh no. Kyle wanting to retire us here. I'm interested to see how what you've built will continue as you both age and spend more time with your family or just get bored churning out content. I love the Syntax brand. I've been coding for 5 years and Syntax has been with me most of the way. I hope it can continue as a source of entertainment and education, also known as edutainment, I think they call that, well into my career. If you want help with producing, I'd love to work with you even on a volunteer basis or to contribute to the community you have cultivated. Well, thank you, Kyle. Kyle, our podcast is edited and distributed by, well, maybe not distributed, but it's edited by the amazing Chris Enns
of Lemon Productions. Chris, you can cut in a little hello here if you like.
Yeah, please do, actually.
Hello, Syntax listeners. Chris Enns here. Nice to meet you. Thanks for asking the question, Kyle. I always love hearing the behind-the-scenes stuff of some of my favorite podcasters, so I'm always happy to chat about how the podcasts I work on get made. And besides editing the audio, I'm also the one who makes any spelling mistakes in the show notes, so be sure to let me know on Twitter at iChris if I mess up the spelling of some technology I have no idea about. Okay, now back to Wes and Scott.
Chris Enns of Lemon Productions. So we'll put in his website so you can see what he's up to. He's also on Twitter and all those things. And Chris does an amazing job cutting and putting together podcasts. He also puts up each episode every single episode. I would have said every single week, but we do a lot of episodes. So
three times a week. And he writes the show notes and makes the clips and everything. Yeah.
And he works with a lot of really excellent content creators as well. So there's a lot of people who trust Chris with his work, and he just does an amazing job for us. As far as distributing the podcast goes, we use Libsyn, Libsyn.com. I don't know if I recommend Libsyn, but it's...
I don't.
Well, see, I wasn't going to go there, Wes, but you can take it there if you'd like.
Yeah, it was the one at the time. There was a couple like startups in the space when we first did it, but like I wasn't ready to...
Oh yeah,
to bet the farm on that type of thing. And now there's much better alternatives out there, but I just honestly don't care that much because the podcast gets put out and we get our stats that we need and whatnot.
Yeah, we don't. I think switching would be a probably much bigger headache than anything. And we're about to hit 20 million downloads of all time. We're at 19,767. So we are less than 200,000 downloads, or less than 300,000 downloads away from 20 million downloads. Holy cow.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Retirement plans. That's a whole thing.
Yeah, the question about like spending more time with our families. Like, this is our job.
Yeah. This is it.
We're not going to retire anytime soon. This is not something where we take time away from our families to do it, because this is our job at the end of the day. So, as we spend, people always say that. I always find that funny. Like, I spend the same amount of time with my family as I always have. I work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And then the other times I don't work. And it's pretty straightforward. So it's not anything you have to worry about.
I spend more time with my family now than ever before, because Syntax has been able to, make it so I don't have to work nights and weekends to try to scrounge up extra cash here and there, because we've been able to do this now successfully for, 5 years, whatever. If to me personally, yeah, I'm spending more time with my family. I'm able to do less working on the weekends. So I know that when we probably first started the podcast, we talked a lot about having those types of things. But yeah, now that I've had a couple of kids, man, I have definitely spending a lot of time with my family. As far as retirement goes, I have a retirement plan through Level Up Tutorials. I'm a salaried employee of my own company. And as far as retirement goes, you just got to contribute to that thing every single year as much as you can, and retire at the normal time that you can.
Yeah, and my retirement plan is to build the next Facebook and sell it to Zuck and get filthy rich off of that.
Yeah.
No, but honestly, like, shout out to everybody for listening, because this is really cool to get paid for this type of thing. Like, we obviously have sponsors on here, and sponsors pay us well, and it's able to support our families and buy houses and things like that. It's really cool.
And shout out to our sponsors, many of which have been here from like day one.
Yeah,
You know, we recorded first three episodes, and then by episode number four, we had some sponsors, you know, that we almost have today still. And like, a lot of our sponsors have been very happy to keep renewing with us over and over again, and we really appreciate you letting us do this kind of thing. It's been amazing.
All right, next question. This one's from Jim Simpson. Hi guys, love the podcast and thank you. I've been working with React for a year or so, and my question is a follow-on somebody's in episode 484 at 3914, the question was, should a majority of Lodash functions be considered deprecated? The response that you should normally use native functions or Angus Kroll's Just library and only what you need because of the weight of Lodash and the speed of native. I'll clarify, Lodash is not a huge weight because you just need to pull in. I don't think we said that. That is a heavy app. That is the misinformation often around Lodash. The question continues. I have the understanding that if using React, Lodash is already pulled in if using Create React app. If that's the case, does that change your answer? It would seem with Lodash already installed, you already paid the price. Would it simply need to import the functions you wish to use in the components? So this is not true. For React to work, React just needs React. And any Lodash functions that I don't think React itself uses any Lodash functions internally, but you may have seen Lodash as a dependency of Create React app. So you probably say, I already installed it. That might be just because of the tooling around Create React app that is used to bundle and create servers and to scaffold data out and whatnot. That doesn't necessarily mean that it is being shipped with your end React application. And furthermore, it also doesn't mean that every single Lodash function is being installed. Generally, you import each function as you need it, and only the code that is necessary for that function, which sometimes could be 5, 10, 15 lines, is going to be included in your end bundle. So it's not as big of a sweat as you might think it is.
Yeah. I don't have anything to add to that. That's pretty dead on.
Speaking of lightweight, ooh. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I consider FreshBooks lightweight because
my bank account. That's speaking of lightweight.
There you go. Speaking of lightweight, my bank account. FreshBooks gets me paid at the end of the day. If you need invoicing and bookkeeping software for your business, you want to send out invoices, you want to keep track of all your expenses, you want to organize your time, you want to track how much time you work for specific clients, FreshBooks is that piece of software for you. You want to check it out. You want to get paid faster. You want to get paid online, late payment reminders, you name it. Check it out. FreshBooks.com/syntax for a 30-day free trial. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick. All right. This next question comes from Anon and says, hey guys, love the pod. I have a funny question. Recently, our backend data has changed whereby dates that were previously required are now optional. While this doesn't seem like a big deal, it has a massive ripple effect through the entire code base. We have a ton of features that depend on due date timestamps that now, because it's optional, a ton of our business logic functions and component state UI is broken. Just wondering if you have any tips or tricks to deal with this. One of my coworkers said maybe just set the default date to 10,000 years from now. So if you know the date is 10,000 years, it's an optional date. Yeah. It seems like the solution is not having dates be optional. That kind of seems like that's the solution. But you know, I thought this one was funny because this seems like, you know, you have like a null state, right, where this thing becomes null. And this is one of the places where TypeScript would save your butt significantly, right? Because if you had TypeScript in here to say, oh, this property is not guaranteed to be here, then it would flag every single point in your code base where you were just saying that, oh yeah, we're using this thing as if it exists. So not saying that you need to use TypeScript or anything like that, but there's oftentimes people where they say, I don't get the need for TypeScript. This is one of those bugs that would be perfectly solved from this. So honestly, my solution to you would be to take that hard work runtime and just find every instance in which this property is being used in your code base and make sure you're handling it correctly. Make sure that you're checking for null, and if it's not null or whatever, you're doing the right thing. And if it is null or if it's not available, if you're using something maybe like optional chaining to see if it's there, you're handling it correctly. I don't know what that means, because you say a lot of your business logic's now broken. Like, I would say, like, you know, make sure this business logic couldn't function correctly without having a date. I wouldn't do the 10,000 days in the future thing, because
you
never know. That just seems like not appropriate.
You're going to have a problem in 10,000 years from now.
You're going to have a problem in 10,000 years from now. So you're probably not going to want to do that, but yeah.
What happens often with that 10,000 years from now is that you're going to want to query things that are in the future, and that thing is technically in the future. So you're going to have it, and you're going to have somewhere where it pops up where, like, this event is in 10,000 years from now, and people are going to screenshot it, and you'll be the laughing stock. And I often see those types of like quick fixes. It probably would be okay to do that, but it sounds like your business logic has changed, so you have to update the business logic of your application. TypeScript will help. Good tests would help as well. But unfortunately, I think this is one of those things where you just have to heads down, figure out how you can go ahead and update all of those, both the UI as well as the business logic, because it has changed. So you need to account for that.
Yeah, Command Shift F dot date. Created at date or whatever this thing is. So just plug away, go to town on it.
Next question is from Sebastian. I'm a system developer from Sweden, and we have had a discussion on how to handle responsive design. In my workplace, we use column 1 to column 12 to handle different layouts. But we were talking and was thinking, why don't we use more CSS functions like media/container query? So what do you think? Is the column system the peak of how we handle CSS, or should we start to use more built-in functions? I think the column, that's a good question. I think the columns, especially 12 columns, is a little old hat. Websites are a much higher definition. They're much bigger and wider than they used to be. So if anything, they definitely go to more than 12 columns. And then also, like, things are a lot more fluid than they used to be. We used to design websites based on very strict snapping queries. And now I think it's much better just to let things take up the amount of space that they need to do. So I would probably reach for more media queries, more Flexbox, FlexGrow, more CSS grid from there. What do you think about that?
I would imagine whatever column-based thing they're doing is powered by media queries behind the scenes, right? I mean, that's how bootstrapping always did. It always shifted the columns around or squished them. But also, you know, it really depends on how the site was designed. To me personally, if the site was designed from a designer designing on a 12 column based system that squishes down to a, you know, 6 column or 3 column or whatever, if that's how the site was designed, build it that way. That's where I would go, because it will save you a lot of time, because you'll just pin things to the columns. But if the site's not designed that way and it's just designed, I don't know, just like a standard layout type of deal, you might be butting up against that thing. the way we do it is we don't use a column-based approach, and haven't for a little while. But I, you know, like I said, that's only because I don't design that way. I design in browser, but now even like the designers we're working with, they're not doing that way. They're building these, like you said, more modern experiences, which are bigger, wider. They're taking up more space. They're maybe less of a on a grid, on a firm grid snapped kind of situation. And those types of websites might benefit from being able to take a look at an approach at each individual section. How does this thing break down, or how do these individual layouts look? What is the responsiveness of those layouts? As far as container queries go, you can't really use them yet, so you'll just have to hope and wait that those things come sooner or later.
Sit around and talk about them like we do.
Yep. Sit around and talk about them for like 10 years and then have Miriam on and have her blow your mind about how awesome they are. So
yeah, go back and listen to that episode.
I'm super pumped for container queries. I cannot wait. I'm like a little kid who's been like, is it Christmas yet? Can I have container queries yet, please?
Yeah. That's great.
Last question we have is from Ryan. It says, hey, Wes and Scott, I was listening to your episode on CSS color functions, but I'm left with the nagging question of why. Well, why do you need this in the browser at runtime instead of pre-calculating the values once as a build step using less or sass? Thank you for all the great info you provide. The big reason why is that like you can have rippling changes throughout your site that happen all in a way that's not possible with pre-configured variables. Think about like you have dark mode on their site, right? You have dark mode. When you toggle dark mode, it's not just toggling one or two values here. It's toggling a lot of things. It's changing how things relate. And many times you end up having like hover values or line values or any of those types of color values that then get adjusted. And I think that can be extremely powerful for not just sites that need dark mode, but sites that need all sorts of theming constraints, or you can have colors that are based on other colors throughout your whole design. And it can all happen in the blink of an eye using CSS variables. So the more control we get over those, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly. Like let's take FreshBooks, for example. You have your own FreshBooks account and you want to be able to theme your invoice. You input your level up purple or your West Boss yellow. And then from that yellow, you can automatically calculate all the values. There's no build step in there. You'd have to throw that to a server side and generate a CSS file for every single one of your clients. Whereas you could simply just set a variable on the body tag and everything else is calculated from there. If your user wants to be able to adjust values as well, that would all be real time. So having it calculated on demand, or as well as we talk about the accessibility of it. Remember we talked about which color is better. You want to be able to blend two colors. You might not know which two colors are ahead of time, right? Like you have, let's say you have 10 colors that someone can choose from in a dark, and then 10 accent colors, and you want to be able to blend those. What are you going to do? Every single possible combination, 10 times 10, that's 100 different variables that you're calculated there. So it's so powerful to be able to not have to worry about pre-calculating all of this data beforehand. In most cases, yeah, that would be fine. But it's so powerful to be able to just do it all at runtime in the browser. And I don't think it takes up a whole lot more. And also, the other thing is like, we just don't, not everybody uses less or sass. CSS is getting really good. People are using just CSS. We're going to get nesting and all of that stuff. So we need all of the features from these things in CSS. And that is the result of it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, that's it for the potluck. If you have any questions, head to syntax.fm, click that button, ask a question. You can leave your own question and we will get to it on the show. If it's good, or if we like it, or, you know, if we're just feeling particularly happy to read your question that day, who knows? And just because we haven't gotten to your question doesn't mean we don't like you or don't like your question. We might not have seen it. So just trying to cover my bases here. Now's the part of the show where we talk about sick picks, things that we pick that are sick, things that we like, things that we enjoy, things that we think are neat. Wes, do you have a sick pick for us today?
Man, I have so many new sick picks with our new house. I'm trying to get it all dialed in. So I have a lot of sick picks. So get ready for the next couple months. I'm going to have some good ones. This one is car sound deadener. So I am in the process of soundproofing my basement office. And one of the steps of that is, what do you do with both the air vents as well as the air returns? And if for those outside of North America, if you're not familiar, we have these big, like tin ducting in most houses in North America. And then there is an air return, which goes back to the furnace. And those things can carry sound through the entire house because they're connected to the entire house. And the ideal thing is to take them out, but you need air and you need to be able to be warm in the wintertime and cool in the summertime. So one thing I'm doing is I took this car sound deadener. It's called butyl rubber, and it's what they put in car engine bays. And if you've ever been in like a luxury car and you shut the door, it's like, it sounds like so nice. Whereas like we shut the door on our Toyota Santa and it's like, so what this is it's like a sticky rubber sticker that you stick onto things that vibrate. And I even saw 3M is coming out with it as well. So if you have anything that rattles or vibrates when you hit it, like even you drop a fork in your sink and you get like ding, 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 like you get that kind of like sound, or if you're spraying water in your sink and you're anytime, that is because metal is vibrating. So I've got this stuff called car sound deadener, and I stuck it all over all the vents and all of the air returns, and it's amazing. The kids are running around upstairs, and it just got so much quieter right away. Like not instantly quiet, but it just got so much quieter from all the vibrations that are traveling through the ducting are absorbed by this butyl rubber, and it's amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think, like, I'm very tempted to take the doors off of our car and to line it with this stuff because it's like, it's relatively, it's like, I don't know, $50 for a pack.
Is it heavy though?
It's extremely heavy.
So yeah. It's going to add some weight to your car if you're.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It like, I don't know, like an entire pack was probably 15 pounds, I would say. So like not a lot for a car, but if you've got anything that is rattly or whatnot, slap some of that on it.
Sick. I'm going to sick pick today a type of glass that I really like. It's these glasses, and I don't mean like eyeglasses, like glasses to drink out of. They look in the shape of like a Coke can, and they're awesome.
Yes.
Man, the lip is the best. They're super thick. You know, I got these on Amazon, and we ended up getting a second box of them because they are just so nice, and they're $20. So it's cheap for four, $20 for four, and they're tanks. They're nice, thick glass, and they look at the exact size dimensions of a soda can or pop can, and it's perfect because you can pour a whole LaCroix in here, and you just know that LaCroix is going to fill the glass. I mean, it's the right size. It's 20 ounces. Is this 20 ounces? Is that what it is? Oh, 16 ounce. Includes four 16-ounce classic can glasses. So I like these things. They're fantastic. They look great, and they're nice. So, yes, drinking glasses.
Those are at every single hipster beer place here, and I love them. The lip feels so good. Yeah, it's like drinking out of a pop can. Big fan of those. They look cool. Yeah, those are really cool.
Yep. All right, cool. Well, let's get into shamelessly plugs. I'm going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. By the time you're listening to this, which is a couple weeks from now, no new progress on the new site, but I'm cruising towards a new website. So you'll want to keep checking leveluptutorials.com. We're really working hard on a new launch of a redesign for this thing. But we have a new course out every single month, including courses on WordPress, modern WordPress, modern Ruby on Rails. Get that, modern Ruby on Rails. We're even having all sorts of really great, amazing JavaScript stuff, including browser APIs and a new course coming on SvelteKit and Supabase. So check it out, leveluptutorials.com. You'll be getting new courses all the time and lots of great content to explore there.
I'm going to shamelessly plug all my courses. Go to westboss.com/courses. You can take a free one or grab a paid one. Any course that you do want, you can use the coupon code Syntax for an extra $10 off.
Sick. All right. Well, we will see you on Friday.
Thank you. Peace.
Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.